Most people picture the Arctic as an isolated place apart from the rest of the world, but half-truths, myths, and fantasies propagated by southern explorers have created this popular image. Today, we'll peel away those layers to reveal the Arctic as still mythic, remote, austere, and romantic, but also as a place connected, as part of the fabric of world history. Today, I'll talk to the curator of Arctic archaeology at the Canadian Museum of Civilization. I'm Bill Hammack, and this is the Afternoon Magazine. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL. If you're in the area or if you're anywhere else in North America, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Let's welcome to the Afternoon Magazine Robert McGee.
Hello, Bill.
Robert, you're the coordinator of Arctic archaeology at the Canadian Museum of Civilization, and I wanted to know, what does this job entail, and does it allow you to travel the Arctic?
It's a research position which entails doing field work in our various Arctic localities, at least whenever the money's available to do that sort of work, to support the exhibitions of that sort of material at the museum, and to not only keep up with the scientific literature and just do research publications and so on, but also try to communicate the findings of research to the public, to seek out the interesting things that we've learned and put them out in publications or other ways in an interesting way, so that what we get excited about will excite a larger number of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, today what I want to do is kind of take a look at the Arctic from prehistory up to today and really add texture to how we think about the Arctic. Now, in your book, The Last Imaginary Place, you note that the myth-making about the Arctic started with the Mediterranean peoples. And could you tell us a little bit about what the Greeks thought of the Arctic?
Well, of course, the Greeks really didn't have any idea of what went on to the north of the mountains up in the Balkans, which was really the northern limit of their horizon. They knew that it was cold up there, that cold winds that withered the vines in Greece occasionally during the winters came from those mountains. And they knew that more or less what they considered to be savage people lived in that region. They also developed the idea that beyond the mountains, beyond the north wind, they said the north wind probably came out of caves in those mountains, and beyond that, out of the reach of the wind, was a land of real delight, a place which they called the Hyperborean region, which was beyond Boreas, the north wind, and the Hyperboreans who lived there lived lives of wonderful ease. They didn't have to work, they didn't get sick, the trees bloomed and bore fruit year-round, so they just picked whatever they wanted to eat, and they were immortals. They sang and danced forever, but after living about 1,000 years, they got tired of all this and had a little ceremony and threw themselves off a cliff into the sea. So it was really a warm and wonderful land far to the north, which was purely out of the Greek imagination.
Now, the word Arctic sounds like it has a Greek root. Is there a Greek root to that word? Does it come from the Greek?
Yes, you're right there. It comes from Arctos, which means the bear, and it refers to the constellation, the Great Bear, what we call the Big Dipper in North America. And what they found interesting about it and its neighboring constellations was that unlike the more southerly constellations, which rose during the evening or during the night and then set towards morning, the constellation of the Great Bear, the Big Dipper, circled around and around in the sky, circling the North Star and staying above the horizon. So they considered the far to the north in the region that underlay these constantly circling constellations lay a land which was probably quite different than the one under which they lived.
Now, the Greeks kind of started this myth-making about the Arctic, but they didn't only engage in myth. They tried to gather some factual knowledge, and at one point they marshaled an expedition. How far did they get, and what were they looking for?
That's right. It was a fellow named Pythias who came from the Greek city of Massilia, which is where the city of Marseille in southern France is now. And in the 3rd century BC, he went north, supposedly looking for, and I'm sure that this is what he was doing, looking for the source of the tin, the mines that supplied tin down to the Mediterranean world, which was very important at the time since it was a constituent of bronze, and bronze was their main metallic material at that time. The tin, of course, came from Cornwall in southwestern England, and he was really just following in the tracks of Phoenicians who had, centuries in the past, worked up the trade routes through the Straits of Gibraltar, up along the Portuguese and Spanish coast, and across to Britain. He did visit the tin mines, and he looked around parts of the country, and he also described a great circular temple of Apollo, which some think may be Stonehenge. He may have seen Stonehenge. Mm-hmm. He then went on sailing further north. We were not sure why, probably just out of curiosity. And he discovered 6 days or so sailing north of Britain an island that he called Thule. And Thule was not a very impressive place. It was filled with sort of savage farmers who didn't grow things very well, and they didn't have very many animals. And it was quite different from the lands to the south. But what was most interesting about it, well, two things were interesting about it. First, that the sun didn't set there at midsummer. And secondly, that when he sailed a day to the north, he ran into an impenetrable barrier, something that he called the sea lung. And from his description, it's impossible to tell what it is. People have thought it may be sea ice. It seems to be he described it as a phenomenon in which the earth and the air and the water all merged into one, and it sort of pulsated across the sea, and nobody could get through it. It sort of sounds like sea ice.
Now, my geography is a little deficient here. When you say he reached Tully, did the Greeks then actually reach into what we would define geographically as the Arctic?
Quite possibly they could have. Nobody knows where Thule actually is. It could have been the Orkney Islands, the Shetland Islands north of Scotland. Iceland has long been a favorite because some of his description fits it very well. The sun, it's barely just below the Arctic Circle, so the sun just doesn't set there at midsummer. And barely a day's sail north of Iceland, you do run into sea ice. But that's a long way for a small Greek sailing ship. And he also described Thule as a place where there were farmers and with cattle and so on. And Iceland almost certainly wasn't occupied at the time. So he may have reached the Norwegian coast somewhere fairly far north. That seems most likely.
So the Greeks and others really saw, in a way, a very fantastical world when they thought about the Arctic. And one of the themes throughout your book is we have these myths and ways to think about the Arctic that came from exploration and from going to colder, coming from warmer climates. But I want to know about the human adaptations that were supported by the Arctic environment. I want to know, what was it like for the indigenous people? And I believe the some of the first people were called, was it the Tunnit?
The people who first lived fairly widely across Arctic North America are people that are very poorly known archaeologically. We simply don't understand them. And we call them by various archaeological names, but the best name probably is the name that the Inuit, the Eskimos themselves, gave to them. And the Eskimos in Arctic Canada say that when their ancestors reached that area, they found it occupied by a strange race of people that they didn't understand. These were big, tall, often sort of semi-giants, very powerful. Sometimes they're described as small people, but always very powerful, who also didn't have the equipment that the Eskimos had and who were easily chased away or killed. And they call these people Tunnit.
Tunnit.
Tunnit. Okay. And archaeologically, we find people who must have been the Tunnit. They first spread across North America from Alaska across to Greenland about 5,000 years ago. And they brought a couple of things that North America had never seen before. One was the bow and arrow, which surprisingly enough was not an invention of the North American Indians, but was probably brought in by the Tunnit and spread to the south after they contacted people to the south. And the other thing they brought was tailored skin clothing, really high-class clothing, the kind that most traditional Siberian peoples wear today, or that the traditional Eskimos of Alaska and other parts of North America wore. So with these two things, that hadn't been seen in North America before, the bow and arrow, skin clothing, they spread rapidly across the entire Arctic world and were the people that really made a living far to the north of Treeline and up in the area of where it's dark for several months in the winter. They made that possible for the first time.
So now you talk about them as an ancient people, but if I read your book correctly, in 1965 you actually visited with them or their descendants, and so they're still around.
Well, that's 1965,
yeah.
Yeah, 65 or so. That was an experience where I was working on an archaeological site up in the high Arctic, about 78 degrees north, on a small island that is in the center of what they call a polynya in the Arctic, which is a region that's kept free of sea ice by strong currents. And in this tiny little island, just a mile or so across, out in the middle of the walrus-filled water and ice and fog, I was shown the remains of a small Tunit village that was about 1,000 years old. And it was covered by a deep snowbank. The first time I went to see it, there was nothing to see but snow. But for about the last 2 weeks in August, the snowbank melted back to reveal this village. And then by the 1st of September, or the second week of September, it was covered by snow again. So this had only been exposed to the surface for about two weeks a year over the past 1,000 years. And it was just as if the people had left there yesterday. And in the fog and the noise of waves and the walrus around, I really expected them to return any time. Their bedding material was still there. One of the little houses, the housewife had put a stone over the hearth to preserve the charcoal for when she came back. So that was a purely imaginary continuation of the Tunit. But in fact, they did stay around until 1902, we now know.
And you describe them at some point, as you envision them, as coughing themselves to death at some point.
That would be the last of the Tunit.
Mm-hmm.
It's always puzzled archaeologists what happened when the Eskimos arrived in Arctic Canada. Did they intermarry with these earlier people? Did they merge their culture in any way? And apparently they didn't, from anything we see archaeologically. They just ignored them or chased them away. And, of course, that's what Eskimo oral tradition tells us as well. So it's probably true, except for one small group of people living on Southampton Island, which is a very isolated island 60 or 80 miles across, up in the northern end of Hudson Bay. And there lived a small group of people called Saglermiut. And they were quite different than the surrounding people. They didn't have metal, for one thing. They made their knives and harpoon heads and so on out of chipped stone, just the way the ancient Tunit had done. And right up into the 19th century, they wore clothing of bear skins, where everybody else wore caribou skins. They didn't have kayaks. They were called Tunit by their Eskimo neighbors. And everybody thought that by this time, Tunit simply meant hillbilly, you know, somebody from long ago, somebody who lived in way out in the outback and was dirty and didn't have all of the technology that the neighbors had. But the DNA people have recently got to work on investigating where the Tunit went, and they conclude, yes, there was no mixing of Tunit with the later Eskimos, except in this one small population, which seems to be genetically a mixture of Eskimos and the earlier Tunit. And unfortunately, this small group of 100 or so people died out completely in 1902. There was a Scottish whaling ship called the Active called in there at the time. They were hunting whales in the vicinity, and a couple of the sailors were sick. Nobody's sure with what. It was probably typhus. And very shortly thereafter, the entire population died off. So the last of the Tunit, the last of the people who for 5,000 years had managed to occupy all of Arctic North America, disappeared.
So we have a caller on line 4 from Eureka. Caller, please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Very interesting conversation. Two questions, please. A recent NBC Nightly News, I believe satellite-enhanced photograph, showed the diminishing of the Arctic ice pack, which seems to have been in the news lately. And I wonder if you could discuss that and or in Alaska, the number of native villages that are having to be moved because of the permafrost melting. And if you could discuss the problem of pollution in the Arctic, please.
Bob?
Okay. I'm not an expert in either of these areas, but I can tell you what I know from talking to people and spending some time up there recently. Yes, the Arctic ice seems to be melting at a greater rate than anyone had expected, and for the past two or three years, there's been a lot less ice in most regions than was previously around. Now, we're at a stage right now where we simply don't know if this is going to be a continuing process or whether it's one of the cycles that we've gone through many times in the past. Back in the 1930s and 1940s, there were similar periods when sea ice was much more reduced than it is now. And then there was a cold coming ice age, and were we ever going to be able to even bring ships into the Arctic to supply the villages? During August, I happened to notice that the trend seems to have been reversed. Whereas earlier in the summer, the ice was melting very rapidly. During August, it melted less rapidly in most areas, and that it's beginning to look more like a normal ice year this year. I know in Alaska, in northern Alaska at least, there was very heavy ice, and there were several cruise ships and supply ships and at least one Canadian military vessel that was making its way through Bering Strait into Arctic Canada were stuck in the ice off Point Barrow for a considerable length of time. So the people on off the North Alaskan coast certainly didn't see it as as an open water year. Whereas I was in the Eastern Arctic just a couple of weeks ago, sailing from Central Arctic across to Greenland and back, and we saw hardly any ice at all. We should have seen more at this time of year. With regards to pollution, a lot of, or at least some of the pollution that all of us are producing from our cars and our factories and so on, does travel over long ranges. And the Arctic, despite the fact that there's very little pollution produced there, aside from the big Russian smelters at Norilsk and a couple of other places in northwestern Eurasia, they do soak up a lot of material that comes in from the south, and this is particularly devastating to the Arctic environment for a couple of local reasons. One is that body fat is very important to Arctic animals. It's a means of conserving of energy and heat, of insulation and conserving energy for the winter. So the much greater extent than southern animals, body fat is an important part of living in the Arctic. And body fat, coincidentally, soaks up many of these pollutants much more readily than other parts. It contains it, it doesn't excrete it, and it accumulates in the body. And since many Arctic peoples live on sea mammals, which are very fatty creatures, both humans and polar bears at the top of the Arctic food chain concentrate a fair bit of this material. So, it has reached an extent where in some regions of western Greenland and the eastern Canadian Arctic, women have been advised not to breastfeed their children because of the accumulation of certain chemicals in their bodies. But I don't know the extent of the studies and how this relates to pollution. If you live in say downtown Chicago, I'm not sure if just how polluted an inhabitant of Arctic Canada would be in comparison to someone in Chicago or even Urbana.
Could I ask a follow up, please?
Yeah, please, sure. Go ahead.
I understand from, again, this is maybe more speculative than confirmed, well documented, that a number of Inuit Native peoples' villages have had to be moved due to the melting of the permafrost. And there was another, again, maybe this is more anecdotal than scientific, on the CBS Evening News about the melting of the permafrost and releasing more methane into the atmosphere than once previously. But I understand certainly weather is, there are many variations within it, even in a trend. But have you heard anything of Inuit villages having to be moved because of the permafrost foundations underneath their houses being melted away?
I've probably heard the same news reports that you did from Alaska, and I've certainly seen it happening in the western Canadian Arctic, which is adjacent to Alaska. It's a combination of permafrost melting and greater storms. Some of these villages lie just about at sea level, or very little raised above sea level, so that when autumn storms encroach into the area with larger waves than they're used to, whole areas can be flooded and villages have to be moved. And I know in the village of Tuktoyaktuk, about 150 miles east of the Alaskan border, whole sections of the town have been undermined and have had to be moved. I remember seeing the curling arena, I think it was, with about one-third of it standing on land and the other two-thirds supported by stilts. So it certainly is happening. It's not a new thing. These things have, when you build on permafrost, it's not totally reliable substance, especially if you don't insulate your house so that the house melts the permafrost itself. So it's a continuing process of moving houses that have been built and built badly on permafrost, but it does seem to be quickening in the last decade or so.
I'm talking with Robert McGee, author of The Last Imaginary Place, A Human History of the Arctic World, and I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Well, our caller addressed the issues of what's happening in the Arctic today and human pollution and other things, but one of the points you make in the book is that the indigenous people were not necessarily always easy on the environment. And could you describe a little bit the hunting practices of those Tuneet societies that we discussed and the effects that that had?
Well, I think the best information on not only prehistoric but also traditional Arctic hunting societies has been put together by Igor Krupnik, who was worked in or did his doctorate in Moscow and did a lot of his work out of there, but now is working for the Smithsonian Institution in Washington and doing some very good work in Alaska. But he put together several characteristics of Arctic hunting societies, that they generally have a lot of children, that they move, they're very mobile, they're able to move from one area to another if the hunting proves bad in the first place, and finally that they all tend to kill as many animals as they can. And this is a way of life that has been passed on throughout the generations and across the polar world, so that and it probably has had relatively little effect on the animals because Arctic peoples are generally fairly scarce on the landscape, and they've never had the technology to cause major damage to the animals that they're living on. But there are certainly some instances of animals having been totally exterminated from local regions or local islands, almost certainly by prehistoric hunters. We have a couple of examples from Banks Island in the western Arctic, which is a fairly large island supporting a large muskox population now of about 80,000, I think it is. But the muskox were wiped out once about 4,000 years ago when the Tuneet first moved into the area. Actually, it was about 500 years after that. And again in the 1850s, after one of the exploration expeditions got their ship locked in the ice up at the north end of the island and finally had to abandon it a few years later. And that was a source of iron and metal and hardwood and everything else for all of the Inuit people of neighboring islands who made pilgrimages up there to obtain material, and in the process seemed to have once again exterminated the muskox on the island.
Now, in your travels throughout the Arctic, you've been able to get almost everywhere. And in fact, after the Soviet Union collapsed, you were able to visit Siberia. And I'd like you to describe the peoples and things that you saw there, and also describe a little bit of what is it that they did with reindeer. How seminal was that to the culture and technology of Siberia?
Traditionally, most northern forest peoples are people who live in the southern tundra, northern forests across the polar world have lived their lives based on what we call the caribou in North America, or what they call the reindeer in the old world. It's exactly the same animal, and they interbreed with one another easily. But whereas most or all North American traditional peoples hunted caribou, in the old world, most northern peoples herded caribou. They had domesticated them to more or less an extent. It was a technology that probably spread northwards from the pastoral peoples who were raising horses and cattle and sheep and goats across temperate regions of Eurasia. And the northern people from the Sami people called who used to be called the Lapps of northern Scandinavia, right across to the Chukchi next to Bering Strait, all participated in hunting or in herding their animals. Some kept them as primarily meat animals, others milked the reindeer, others used the large reindeer to pull sleds, some rode on top of the reindeer, and they all had different systems of balancing their way of life with that of the animals that they kept. But this became a commercial enterprise after the Soviet Union took over the region and eventually during the 1930s with a lot of heartache and problems. The herds were collectivized and on the sort of model cooperative farms and later of state farms, reindeer herders became paid employees of the state. Now, this allowed for fairly efficient reindeer herding. I know in Chukotka there were vast numbers of reindeer back in the 1970s, 1980s. Very good veterinary coverage. Everything was well organized. The herders had mechanical tractors to take them out and to follow the herds and so on. But after the Soviet Union collapsed around 1989 or 1990, it became apparent that none of these operations, these economic enterprises out on the fringes of the Soviet Union, were really very viable at all. A lot of the Russians and Ukrainians who had previously lived in the area, for the same reason that people in North America go north to Alaska or the Arctic regions because the pay is better and you get northern bonuses and so on. A lot of these people left and went back to what they call the mainland, central Russia. And the people who were left were living with essentially collapsed economies. There was no markets for the reindeer meat anymore or the for the furs that they were growing in the fur farms or for the whale meat that they'd been hunting in order to feed the animals in the fur farms. And it was simply a very bad economic situation.
Now, I spent a very small amount of time in the Arctic. I was in the Arctic Circle of Sweden near a town called Jukkasjärvi. Mm-hmm. I was a vacationer there. I use the latest kind of technology and clothing that we have. I mean, the fleeces and other things. And so I was surprised to learn from your book that reindeer skins make great lightweight insulated clothes. And in fact, you say they're unsurpassed for Arctic clothing. Have you actually compared the modern day to the reindeer, and do you have a preference?
Well, I wouldn't personally like to argue this out with L.L. Bean or whoever's distributing the highest class mountaineering gear, but I am pretty sure that an Inuk woman that with whom I was traveling a couple of weeks ago in Arctic Canada would have no trouble making that argument. She's a specialist in traditional skin clothing and makes and sells it as a line of fashions based on traditional skin clothing. And I think if she and the foremost producer of mountaineering clothing were put into a debate and given a few scientific testing pieces of testing equipment, I think they'd I would put my money on her.
Very interesting. So when we're looking at these changes in the Arctic, we kind of looked at prehistory and at the Greeks a little bit and at the Chuneet people. But eventually the Vikings began to expand into North America. So what did the Norse do, and how does it still affect the Arctic today?
The Norse began expanding out of Norway, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, about 800 AD. And we all know the Viking raids going down into England and Ireland and France and into the Mediterranean and so on. But there was also a smaller movement westward, and these were mainly by farmers, people who were looking for new farming land. They weren't looking to raid monasteries and so on. But they were probably, you call them local warlords, who had been put out of business by the growing power of the Norwegian king. And in order to retain their position in society, they were looking for new pieces of land where they could set themselves up. And Iceland was discovered around the 860s, and began to be settled around the 870s, and by 60 years later, it was totally filled up. There was large numbers of people. There was no more farmland. They then went on, according to legend, went on to Greenland, a land that was discovered by Eric the Red after he'd murdered too many people in Iceland and had been exiled.
Mm-hmm.
And he came back, said he'd found this wonderful land called Greenland, and it was wonderful pasturage, and sure enough, a lot of people followed him there, and it sounds as if he was a real estate promoter and giving a good name to a country that we know is full of ice and gray rock. But actually, southwestern Greenland is extremely green, and it's very good pasturage for sheep and goats and maybe a few small cattle. People still make a good living sheep farming in southwestern Greenland today. So that just around 1000 AD, Icelanders began to move to Greenland, and there was a small nation established there. Something between 2,000 and 5,000 people probably lived in Greenland for the following 500 years. Now, that's as long as the time from Christopher Columbus to the present day. So this was no flash in the pan. It was a little outpost of European society, and they maintained contact with Europe to the extent that they wore the latest in European fashions. They had churches. They eventually, 200 or 300 years later, managed to get a bishop, and they did that by sending a polar bear as a gift to the church in Europe, for which in return they got a bishop. The two seemed to be equivalent at the time, and established this small European farming society. But in order to maintain contact with Europe, they needed goods to trade for iron, trade for the bishop's vestments, to trade for probably grain. They weren't growing any of very little, if any, grain in Greenland. And they needed furs, polar bear furs, the occasional live polar bear, falcons. The gyre falcon of Greenland and the eastern Arctic became huge in the courts, medieval courts of Europe. They needed walrus skins. Walrus skins, you cut them into thin lengths and or thin strips, and they become ship's rigging, the best ship's rigging in medieval times. And ivory. Ivory from the walrus and from the narwhal, very valuable in Europe. And there are accounts of them trading vast numbers of walrus, or not trading, sending vast numbers of amounts of walrus ivory to Europe to pay their taxes, to pay taxes to the Norwegian king after he took them over, and to pay tithes to the church after they became Christianized. And in order to get these materials, southwestern Greenland, being a fairly ice-free land, doesn't have many sea mammals or other bear or polar bears, nor many walrus, so they were probably all hunted out. And the Norse began to range probably fairly widely around the coasts, up west Greenland, across to Baffin Island, down to Labrador. And we know from the archaeological find in a site called Lancemeadow at the northern end of the Big Island of Newfoundland that they tried to establish a settlement there at about 1000 AD. They were chased out of that by the natives. But further to the north, in lands where they were occupied by the Tunit, these relatively harmless prehistoric people of the eastern Arctic, they seem to have established some kind of long-term trading relationships, trading small bits of metal for walrus ivory, almost certainly, and perhaps living on the coast of North America to some extent. This is very recent information that's come from, in fact, at the time that the book was published, we didn't know hardly any of it, so I barely mentioned it. But since that time, Patricia Sutherland, who's my colleague of mine at this museum, has been finding archaeological remains of what look very much to me like Norse settlement in Baffin Island and probably in Labrador.
Now, you make the argument in the book that there was a certain migrations because actually of this metal and metal trading. Is that correct?
It's always been a question, why did the Eskimos move eastward from Alaska.
So if we could just take a step back for a moment, the word Inuit and Eskimo, those are synonymous, is that correct?
They're synonymous.
Okay.
In Canada, the people, the Eskimos of Canada generally call themselves Inuit, and the language that they speak, Inuktitut, spreads from just about Bering Strait across North Alaska, across Arctic Canada, and all the way around Greenland. So they speak the same language and can understand one another, although it gets a bit tricky. It's like somebody from Glasgow trying to understand somebody from Houston. But they can understand one another. And so Inuit is the term they call themselves, and it's generally a term that's applied to them. In Alaska, it's become a more politically correct term than Eskimo, although a lot of Alaskan people quite proudly refer to themselves as Eskimos, as do Siberians.
So at some point, though, they expanded eastward from Alaska to most regions of Arctic Canada and Greenland, and this is a very famous migration. And you make in this book specific arguments about why that happened that are at the time somewhat controversial.
Well, perhaps the traditional view of who the Inuit are has developed over the last few centuries from explorers who found these people living in what they thought of as total isolation in an environment where Europeans simply couldn't survive, and they were so puzzled by how they could do this that they more or less assumed that they were the heirs of a long ancient tradition of the survival of old Stone Age Arctic ways, the sort of ways of life that you see in the caves of Europe from 15, 20,000 years ago, that these people were products of this long, slowly changing tradition of adaptation to the Arctic environment, just like the seals and the caribou and the muskox. They had gradually adapted this very unique way of life, which allowed them to be the only people who could survive in the Arctic. And with that in mind, when archaeologists began to find that you can only trace the history of Inuit in Greenland or Arctic Canada back for several hundred years, but that much older Inuit or Eskimo occupations occurred in Alaska, they say, okay, these people must have come from Alaska at some time. The date of 1000 AD was picked, more or less picked out of a hat, but it seemed to fit a lot of the early radiocarbon dating evidence, and began to think of people expanding eastwards during a period of warming climate, which very much like that which we're facing today, which became known as the medieval warm period. And it affected northern Europe. Wine was being made in England and Germany and so on. And in Arctic Canada, there was sea ice was reduced. This was the period of the Viking voyages and Norse voyages. They rarely saw sea ice across the North Atlantic. And so perhaps the Inuit had expanded slowly, just as animal species will expand into a new environment, following the whales and the seals of the Alaskan waters eastwards until a few centuries later they had occupied all of Canada and Greenland. A very nice theory, nice picture of how these people would slowly expand. But humans really don't work that way when you come to think about it. Humans simply don't slowly expand to take care to take in new environmental resources. What they do is they make quick jumps. And what now seems to fit all of the radiocarbon dating evidence that we've got and everything else is that the first Inuit in Arctic Canada or Greenland aren't in the Western Arctic adjacent to Alaska, but they're far up in the northeastern Arctic where Arctic Canada and Greenland come together. And the people that appeared up there around 1200, 1250 AD, something like that, were carrying tools and weapons that looked practically identical to the ones that were being used around Bering Strait. And in fact, one or two pieces of pottery that they had turned out on analysis to have been actually made from Alaskan clay. Mm-hmm. Now, if you've done any camping, you know the pottery doesn't last an awful long time in camping. And when you're doing a lot of traveling in the Arctic, a pot doesn't last a century or so. It lasts more like 3 weeks. So you have this very rapid movement of people from Bering Strait right across to the Eastern Arctic around 1250 AD, which is just exactly the same time that the Norse began talking about meeting people far up in the north beyond their settlements. And the interesting part of this area where we find the stuff in the east. There's a large iron source close by, a bunch of iron-rich meteorites at a place called Cape York that were discovered by the Tunit a few centuries earlier, and which began to be traded widely across the Arctic world. And the earliest Inuit sites up in this area not only have meteoric iron, but they're full of Norse material as well. Pieces of chainmail armor, not just little bits of it, woolen cloth, pieces of oak wood, a carpenter's plane missing its blade, all sorts of material comes out of these sites. So what I'm suggesting is that what seems to make sense is that people in Alaska, hearing that there was a source of iron, which was very important to all Eskimo peoples in the past, far to the east, 5,000 kilometers or so to the east, managed to move there over a period of 2, 3, 5 years. We don't know how long it took. And once having established a relationship with the Norse incomers, who had been there for a couple of centuries already, then began to expand to fill out the entire eastern Arctic. The people who made this move were not, as we used to think, the sort of whale-hunting villagers of North Alaska, but they were the people from around Bering Strait. And these guys had not only lots of seals and whales to live on, but for perhaps the past 2,000 years, they had something else. They controlled the iron trade from Siberia across to the New World. And we don't know how important that is, because iron is archaeologically just about invisible. It rusts and disappears very shortly after it's dropped in the ground. But there are indications that there was a fair bit of iron coming across, and the people who occupied Bering Strait were very powerful people. They were people who were at the same time importing armor technology from further south, making imitations of Japanese and Chinese slat armor made out of ivory instead of metal. They had the Mongol type of bow, which was being taken into Europe at that time on horseback. And these rather fierce people, very commercially oriented people around Bering Strait, I think were almost certainly the first Inuit who moved eastwards across the Canadian Arctic. So instead of looking at the Inuit today as people who are sort of survivors of an ancient and unchanging way of life that goes right back to the Ice Age, it's much more realistic to look at them as an entrepreneurial people out of the rich countries of the North Pacific who made a fantastic move at some time in the past, and whose way of life has been conditioned by contacts with the outside world ever since.
And we only have a minute or two left, but I'd like to squeeze in a caller. We have a caller from Champaign on line one. So line one, please go ahead with a short question, if you would.
Hi, yes. I wondered if you could discuss at all the dogs that the Inuits had. I breed Alaskan Malamutes, and so I'm very interested in the history of the people with the dogs, and if you have any reference books that might talk about how the Inuit used the dogs or the source from where the dogs came from.
Bob, we're close to the end of our time. We have a minute or two left, but can you address for that caller in a short fashion?
I'll give it a try. I don't know an awful lot about dogs, and I do know of a couple of reference books, but I can't put my hands on them or think of them right now. All we know is that all Arctic peoples have always had dogs with them. Although the Tunit seem to have very few of them, it probably isn't possible to live life in the Arctic without dogs, for either for freighting purposes, as the Eskimos used them for, or for hunting purposes, for finding seal holes in the ice, or for hunting polar bears, that sort of thing. And you probably, or certainly the breeders, probably know more than I do about the history of the Eskimo dog. Now, what I see from personal, just being a dog lover and being interested in dogs that I see, is that there's a fair bit of variability across the Arctic. The Alaskan dogs do look more like Siberian dogs. The ones in the eastern Arctic, which have probably had some interbreeding with other animals over the time, are much larger, much tougher looking guys with a lot of scars. They probably do all come out of some ancient Arctic dog, but where and when this dog was first domesticated, I simply have no idea.
Bob, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Well, thank you.